Double bubble, Warren Rubble. When you mess with women, you'll be in trouble. We're convicted of murder if abortion is planned. Convicted of shame if we don't have a man. Convicted of conspiracy if we fight for our rights. And burned at the stake when we stand up and fight. Double bubble, Warren Rubble. When you mess with women, you'll be in trouble. We curse your empire to make it fall. When you take on us, you take on us all. Woo!
Gerber reporting for KPFA. What you've been hearing is the sounds of 300 women at the gates of the federal prison in Pleasanton, California, at a demonstration for International Women's Day in early March. Such demonstrations in front of prisons are part of International Women's Day tradition around the world to show support for political prisoners and prisoners of war and all women locked down in prisons. Last February, I visited Laura Whitehorn and Linda Evans, two of the political prisoners being held in Pleasanton a couple of weeks before this demonstration. These women are both North American anti-imperialists being held at Pleasanton as a result of their political activities in support of black liberation. They were arrested in the spring of 1985. They also have long histories in the women's and lesbian movements and as far back as the civil rights and the anti-war movements. Evans is serving a 45-year sentence, and Whitehorn was just paroled on a 2-year sentence, but is now being held in preventive detention at Pleasanton while awaiting trial on further charges. Why the long sentences? Why preventive detention? Linda Evans.
I think the main reason that I'm a political prisoner and in prison now with a sentence of 45 years altogether is because I was part of and am part of building a resistance movement in the United States. And I worked in clandestinity for several years, trying to expand the capabilities of anti-imperialist and anti-racist progressive movements. The charges were using a false name to buy 4 legal guns in Louisiana, harboring a fugitive, and being a felon in possession of a gun when I was arrested in New York.
There are between 150 to 200 political prisoners and prisoners of war in the U.S., The government refuses to acknowledge this. However, along with extraordinarily long sentences, political prisoners are treated differently inside from other prisoners. Laura Whitehorn explains.
what I'm doing here at Pleasanton is serving a 2-year term for making false statements on a passport, which is something that no one ever goes to jail for. And if I weren't a revolutionary anti-imperialist, the judge basically said that. If I had been using a false passport to make money, to do some shady business deal, I would have gotten probation or, you know, a warning from the judge or something. I wouldn't be doing 2 years for it. So in my case, and the cases of Linda Evans, who you're going to be talking to, and other North American political prisoners who were arrested around the same time, we've all been charged with crimes, but really what the government says about us is that we were responsible for a series of armed actions, including the attack on the U.S. Capitol after the invasion of Grenada. And they've never brought those charges against us, and I happen to believe the reason they haven't is because they don't want to politicize our cases. They don't want to give us a chance to say we're political prisoners. They say we're just criminals. We just broke the law. They say she's not a political. But when you look at it, Linda Evans is doing 45 years, 40 of which are for, she was convicted for buying 3 guns. Most people don't go to prison for that. And Susan Rosenberg and Tim Blanc are doing 58 years for possessing explosives at the a few months before they were sentenced. These abortion clinic bombers, right-wingers, were sentenced for bombing, for using similar explosive materials to bomb abortion clinics and endanger women and children. And they got the most that one of them got was 10 years.
Evans and Whitehorn have been political activists for over 20 years, gaining their first understanding of the injustices of American society from active participation in the civil rights movement.
I do think that we need revolution in this country in order to ever be able to wipe out racism, in order to ever have economic justice, certainly in order for women to ever have any part of equality, much less liberation, certainly to end gay oppression. Like a lot of white people in this country, I was brought up in an area where there were really no black people. I was brought up in Iowa, in the heart of the Midwest. And, for instance, there was one black person in our whole high school. And when I left Fort Dodge, Iowa, and went away to college, which I never finished, but certainly started opening my eyes, I began to realize that there were tremendous differences between the life that I had been brought up to live and what most people experience, certainly most people in the world. But I think at that point I was motivated by some kind of moral outrage against that vast difference between the opportunities that I knew I would have as a white middle-class woman and what most black people were able ever to experience.
When I was a kid in high school, I joined the civil rights movement in some kind of vague ways because I thought segregation was wrong. It just seemed to me completely wrong that black people were discriminated against for being black. I had been brought up to, like a lot of other liberal children, to believe that people were equal. So why weren't they being treated that way? And as the years went by and the civil rights movement developed, I saw an intense morality being exhibited by black women, children, and men, in the South in particular, but all over the country. And if that couldn't change the system fundamentally, if people in power and white people in general didn't look at that and say, this is morally right, and segregation, racism, white supremacy are morally wrong, and therefore we're going to change it. If that wasn't possible, if white people weren't willing or capable of doing that, then something fundamental had to change about the society. And then in the 60s, and I don't think it's just a matter of the 60s, I think that was the beginning of something, not the end of something, when national liberation struggles, such as the black struggle within this country, and the Vietnamese in particular, showed that they had a strategy to defeat their own oppression and to free themselves. And then, as I've seen in Vietnam, when that actually reaches fruition and there's a free society, that seems something worth fighting for. For 20 years, that's what I've dedicated myself to. So, you know, there's one thing that I've found as I've been moved from one jail to another, is that every place I go, the police try to spread the word that I believe in violence. you know, that this is a person who believes in violence, which is, you know, a very creepy thing to say about a person who believes in violence, an axe murderer. No revolutionary, no one who struggles for human rights believes in violence. What we believe is that the violence of the system has to be ended, and that people have tried for years to do that without violence.
Prison conditions for all prisoners are difficult, but political prisoners face further complications. Laura Whitehorn.
It's subtle because they don't want to come right out with things, but we've had to fight for certain rights under the BOP regulations that other prisoners don't have to fight for. They treat our visits differently, for example. Everyone sees that. Other visitors can meet each other's families, play with each other's children, you know, sit and talk for a few minutes if they want. We go near each other and they threaten to terminate our visits. If I have a visit and Linda has a visit or Carmen has a visit and our visitors try to talk to different ones of us. We just had to put in an administrative remedy because they weren't allowing anyone who was on my visiting list couldn't be on Linda's visiting list, and that's not in BOP regulations, so we just had to. The other thing
did
is...
Did you win that one?
Yes, we just won it. The other thing is censorship, and this never happened until we got here. Censorship of what we wear. The reason why I'm wearing a keffiyeh, and Linda will probably wear her keffiyeh, because this is one of the few things that we can still wear that has political significance. I had a T-shirt that Susan Rosenberg had embroidered for me. She's another political prisoner. That said, political prisoner. Very small. They confiscated it after I was here for a few weeks. Apparently the warden saw me wearing it and thought that it was disruptive to the security of the institution.
The control unit at the Federal Women's Prison in Lexington, Kentucky, is where three women political prisoners are currently being held. Activists all around the country, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union, pressured the Bureau of Prisons to shut Lexington down, citing it as cruel and inhuman punishment. In response, the Bureau of Prisons has agreed to close Lexington, but announced at the same time they will be opening a high-security unit for 150 women at Mariana, Florida. All the women political prisoners and prisoners of war at Pleasanton expect to be shipped there. Laura Whitehorn.
One of the things about being in prison and giving up control over your own life is that any day they can come and just pack you out and ship you off any place that they decide, and you don't have any warning. So it's very hard to do anything because we have no idea when and if we'll be shipped. We believe we're going to Mariana because it is, as you said, it's a political prison. It's also going to be for other quote-unquote high-security women, which in my experience is mostly not determined by what you're in jail for, but by how much you stand up for your own rights while you're in jail. So I think that's who will be in Mariana with us. It was really kind of a tragedy when they moved the low-security women out of here, because they moved people, they just uprooted people whose children had been able to visit. And the one thing you could say about this place is that if you live near here, it has pretty good visiting. And people who were able to see their children and their families and who are low-security got shipped up to Washington State. We don't know all of the ins and outs of the BOP plans, but one thing I can say that we have, all the political prisoners and POWs here have discussed and that we agreed to, is that the federal system is tightening up in general, that the control unit that's being built, that's in operation in Lexington, mm-hmm. is not an aberration. And one thing that they do, particularly in control units, is that you don't have a set of standard rules that people know. In other words, you change the rules every day. Someone does one thing one day, it's okay. The next day, you throw them in the hole for it. Keeps people off balance. It means that you can't plan even a whole day in advance, much less plan your life. Today, you can have books here. By March 31st, they say that you're only going to be able to have 3 books. But they change some of these rules without telling you. They have laws like this, a rule that all searches have to be conducted, of a prisoner's body, have to be conducted in such a way as to preserve the dignity and privacy of the prisoner. But all they have to do to change that and to be completely intrusive and humiliating to you is to say, well, security demands it. And they do it all the time, and especially to women. There's been a number of incidents where women have been abused sexually, I would say, by female guards and male guards. By female guards, when they were made to give urine samples naked which is completely humiliating. It's like being treated worse than a dog. And women didn't know that they could refuse that until we made a stink and tried to investigate the regulations and finally found out that they're not supposed to do that. Or the men, when there are men pat search women all the time here, and if you refuse it, you end up not getting your visit or waiting around for an hour before something happens, and they're supposed to pat search you in a way that's dignified to you. You know, they don't do that. And when you try to question them about it, you would have to wait an hour. I wouldn't have been able to have this interview. If you question their methodology, you end up paying for it in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they keep people from asking too many questions. That means that there's a lot of passivity among the population, because no one wants to rock the boat, because the little crumbs that we've got could be taken away. And to me, that's as much of an enforcement technique as brutalizing people.
Isolation is difficult to fight against in prison. As Whitehorn said to me, if we don't know what's going on in the world, we can't stay connected to the movement outside. I asked both women how they fight the isolation and continue to have political lives in prison.
The government would love it to stop. That's one of the reasons that they isolate prisoners, but it certainly doesn't stop. I mean, I would be lying to you if I said I'm as much a part of the movement now as I was before I was arrested. That would be ridiculous. But we struggle to be part of the movement in whatever ways we can. So your politics really are a part of your every waking moment. Not that you are chanting slogans or holding up banners, or even since we're not allowed to wear many political things, it's hard to demonstrate your politics through anything other than how you live your life every day.
A lot of people have asked me whether or not your life ends as a political person when you come into jail. And it's so much not the case. I mean, certainly it's transformed, it's changed. And it means that you have to be constantly aware of how you can resist what their program is against you. I think that for us, in terms of inside in our daily lives, the most important thing that we do is to try to be real clear that we're very opposed to racism and that we support the black prisoners in particular who are here. The whole federal prison system is extremely racist in its structure, in its discrimination against people in hiring. Racism is just a daily occurrence as far as guards' attitudes, as far as other prisoners' attitudes. Mainly, it comes down to supporting the programs that the black prisoners try to put on. Whenever we see a racist incident take place, then we try to confront the white person in that situation and make it clear that we think that racism is really disgusting, and organize other white prisoners to oppose that. For instance, there was a white woman that called one of the black cooks an extremely derogatory name that I won't use. And at that point, some of us were working in the kitchen, and she also was working in the kitchen, this racist. And the whole dish room, which was the part of the kitchen she worked in, refused to work with her.
Political prisoners around the world try to gain the right to association with other political prisoners when inside. Evans talks about what a difference it has made to them to be held with four Puerto Rican prisoners of war.
I think that part of maintaining our identity as political people inside prison is our own internal development. And here we are very privileged and glad to be with the Puerto Rican prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. Delcia Pagan, Aide Torres, Carmen Valentin, and Lucy Rodriguez. And so, consequently, we have some comradeship, which is very, very precious to us and has made our internal political life much, much richer than it has ever been able to be when any of us has been alone. So that's very important. We study. We're really trying to develop kind of a constant political dialogue about what's going on in the world, to consciously fight against the isolation that is so much the government strategy of dealing with us. Correspondence has been a very important part of it. Having people come to visit us has been very important. People sending us literature and books has been very important, because inside you become totally dependent on the bourgeois media, you know, mainstream media for your news. And that's just not what's going on.
You're listening to Laura Whitehorn and Linda Evans, two North American political prisoners being held at the federal prison at Pleasanton, California. Both women are lesbians and talked about what it's like to be out in the federal prison system.
One of the things that we battle in here all the time is anti-gayness, because a lot of people don't understand what it is to be a lesbian. But it's more of a political issue here than anything else, because prison denies people their sexuality. You know, sex goes on in prison, but sexuality and sexuality as a form of human expression is really one of the things that's very controlled and very repressed.
People make comments, the guards make comments to different ones of the women who are lesbians here. Some of the prisoners make comments toward us. Because it's a co-ed prison where there are men and women both, it means, and there are more men, there are twice as many men as women, it means that there is a premium placed on heterosexual relationships. All the men want to have relationships with the women, partly because they don't know when they'll be in a co-ed prison again. So there's a lot of pressure on women to relate to men. And it comes in a lot of different forms, from being propositioned to being, to having it suggested that you could sleep with somebody for money, to sometimes physical attacks. And it's a problem in general when you don't, when you make it clear that you're gay, you don't want to have a relationship with a man, then certainly you're marked for certain types of comments and such as that from some of the men. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other ways that lesbians are really discriminated against in some ways is in visits, and who can visit us, what kind of physical contact is acceptable during visits between lesbians. And although there aren't trailer visits in the federal prisons where you have a conjugal visit and you can be alone together for a weekend or overnight, certainly in the state prisons, lesbian women are not allowed to have those kind of visits and that kind of privacy to maintain any kind of relationship. So it means that really you're dependent on being able to visit in the situation of being friends, but certainly no sexual contact, no kind of kisses when you're leaving or coming to visit, which of course men and women are allowed to have.
Women in prison face constant sexual abuse and humiliation.
We live in cells that are double bunked, that are very much too small for two people, but they have a window in the door, and there are male guards. We don't have a single woman guard in our unit on any shift. It's all men. They say, when we say they should have women guards, they say, we just don't have enough women guards. Which, what it means is that at any time of the night or day, you are basically exposed to men. You can't ever relax and think that you can take a shower without the threat of being exposed to a man. They can come in your room at any point. We have little things called wicks that you can put in the window when you're using the bathroom or changing your clothes, but that doesn't stop them. They look over them or they open the door anyway. And we've had a lot of screaming fights with the guards about this. But in their policy, it states that they can open your door and look at you anytime they want to. And it's both the practice of that, but also the threat of that, that is so degrading to women in here. And I think that that's general practice in the federal system.
2 weeks before International Women's Day, I asked the women how they felt about a demonstration happening at the gates of the prison.
We're very excited about it. We're looking forward to that kind of support, and I think that the people who have been working outside to organize the demonstration are doing a great job. For us, it's kind of an ongoing struggle. to try to get people on the outside to realize that there are political prisoners and prisoners of war here, and what that means for our movement. Because I think in general, prison conditions and the situation of prisoners has been really ignored. It's hard to maintain ourselves as part of the progressive movement. You know, I think once you go to prison, a lot of people tend to forget about you, and you either become a memory, you know, it might be a very beloved memory, but nonetheless very far in the past. The demonstration means that we are brought more into people's consciousness.
One thing that it means that's very important to us is that what goes on in here is less invisible than the police would like it to be. In other words, they get away with a lot of stuff because people on the outside don't know about it, and we have very few remedies. We have very few things we can do. Mm-hmm. So having people outside knowing about that is important. We get strength from you out there. We get strength from people out there, from people's resistance out there. We listen to the news every night to hear, was there a demonstration in support of the Palestinians? And part of us feels, ooh, I wish I could be there. But mostly what we feel is, that's great, that's good that people are resisting, that people are expressing opposition to Zionism and support for the Palestinian struggle for self-determination. What we're saying is that people should support us in our ongoing struggle against the government and against the system of U.S. imperialism. And that if you recognize at some point in your life that things in this country are not right, that it's not the kind of society you want to bring your kids up in, that you believe, as many great thinkers have believed, that you can't be free as long as you enslave someone else, and that if you're, for me as a white woman in this country, that I couldn't live a full productive life as long as I was living in a society that was built on the backs of black people in this country, Native Americans, Mexicano people, Puerto Ricans, and every other nation around the world. At some point, you decide what you want to do about that. Well, I made a decision that I wanted to fight it and try to win.
They got women on TV, but I still ain't satisfied. 'Cause co-optation's all I see, and I still ain't satisfied. They call me Miss, they sell me blue jeans. They call it women's lip, they make it sound obscene. And I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't, whoa, they lied. And I still ain't, whoa, they lied. And I still ain't satisfied.
You've been listening to Laura Whitehorn and Linda Evans, two North American political prisoners being held in the federal prison in Pleasanton, California. Still Ain't Satisfied was written by Bonnie Lockhart and performed in front of the gates of Pleasanton by three of the members of Swing Shift. This program was produced by Judy Gerber at KPFA in Berkeley, California.
Abortion still is legal here, but I still ain't satisfied. 'Cause that might not be true next year. I still ain't satisfied. The right to life means no right for us. If you agree, join in the chorus. And I still ain't, whoa, they lied. I still ain't, whoa, they lied. And I still ain't, whoa, they lied. And I still ain't satisfied. Well, this world sure don't look my way, and I still ain't satisfied. 'Cause every minute a woman is raped, I still ain't satisfied. They say, okay, we'll buy you a street light, but they get uptight when we learn to street fight. And I still ain't, oh, they lied. I still ain't, oh, they lied. And I still ain't, oh, they lied. And I still ain't satisfied. I got some pride, I won't be lied to. I did decide that halfway won't do. And I still ain't, oh, they lied. And I still ain't, oh, they lied. And I still ain't, oh, they lied. And I still ain't satisfied.